This is TWiT.
Online porn continues to vex lawmakers, parents, and privacy advocates. And one big reason for that is that we don't like to talk about it very much. So let's talk about it. Joining us now is Louise Mitsakis, a staff writer at Wired, covering cybersecurity, internet law, and online culture. Welcome, Louise.
Hey, thank you guys so much for having me.
So the piece you wrote this week focuses on online regulations about pornography and how difficult it is to keep pornography from children while also respecting the rights of adults. Talk a little bit about the current legislation that they're working with.
So I think before we kind of talk about the specifics of the legislation, it's important to know that they're kind of the brainchild of this crazy guy. He's like, you know, said he's addicted to porn. He tried to marry his Apple computer. He's, you know, been convicted of assault. He's harassed a number of people, including a 17-year-old girl. But state lawmakers have kind of ignored that anyway. And they've been considering this legislation that would basically make it so that minors could not access porn unless they went, put their name down, paid $20 per device, and signed an agreement basically saying that they accept the risks of accessing pornography.
So this is Chris Sevier that you're talking about, and that was in the 90s?
No, so that's actually going through the state houses right now.
Oh, okay.
But I kind of make this comparison in my piece about how this happens all the time. So yeah, no, that bill is actually being considered in states like Rhode Island. It's being considered in Texas. Rhode Island was kind of the flashpoint in the last couple of weeks because the lawmakers there don't even seem to know what they're trying to accomplish. And they're just kind of like blindly like, yeah, we don't want people to access porn. Let's just like listen to this guy. But these bills have a really long history. Like, you know, starting in the 1990s with Bill Clinton, he signed a number of bills that were later deemed unconstitutional. I think that's important to note, that tried to restrict minors' access to porn. And I think it's really interesting because, you know, this is decades before 11-year-olds had smartphones.
Yeah, you point out in your article the Child Online Protection Act of 1998 was one of those that you're talking about, you know, deemed unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. It used age verification by way of credit card authorization in that case. If that was shot down, what would make this approach so much different? It kind of seems born of the same thing, same idea.
It's not. They're really very similar, which is kind of the problem. And I think that if any of them were to pass in a state, they would face immediate constitutional challenges from the ACLU that would end up just being expensive. There's just this long, alluring desire to restrict minors' access to porn. And I think what I point out in my piece is that meanwhile, less than half of states mandate sex education. So that seems like a good place to start. If you don't want kids to learn about sex from porn, then maybe mandate sex education. They won't be so interested in learning about norms of sexual activity from, you know, online explicit material.
Yeah, I'm like the favorite mom at cocktail parties and other gatherings of parents, because I'm like, your kids have seen porn. They have. The average age is 7 years old. It's not, there's nothing you can do. There's no parental technology. There's no technology that you can do to keep them from seeing it. You know, 7 is the average age kids are seeing it these days. So you got to talk to them about it, you know, which nobody wants to do. But I love that your piece really had that specific statistic that 62% of females say they viewed porn in adolescence, and I guess 93% of males, and yet only 24% of states mandate sex education, as you said. So yeah, it's a little bit complicated. And so I want to bring up what you said, what part of the legislation was for people, if they wanted to view porn, they had to put their name on a list somewhere.
Yeah.
Which is, as you said, would not be constitutional necessarily. But what are some other pitfalls of trying to legislate keeping porn out of the hands of kids?
Well, I think one of the problems is that it's not just on explicit porn sites. Like, it's not on just like a tube site or on like a site that's like actually for adult content. There's plenty of user-generated porn on sites like Reddit and Tumblr. And it's not as simple as just blocking the like truly XXX like hardcore pornography sites. And I think that you risk not being able to draw a line between things like sex education, LGBT content, and where does it really become porn? I think that especially on the internet, you know, there's a lot of like artwork. It's really difficult to decide where that line is. And it's, you know, we can't keep white supremacist propaganda videos off YouTube. I highly doubt that state legislators are going to be able to keep porn out of, you know, teenagers' hands. It just seems like such an insurmountable task.
So who is managing that, though? So I know in the case of the Rhode Island proposed bill, you know, there are these filters that that end up being applied. And I guess that always ends up being the question in something like this, right? Like the idea might be, it might be a noble cause to say, hey, we really don't want our kids viewing pornography. Let's not do nothing and let's do something about it. But when you enter the realm of applying filters, someone has to execute on those filters. Someone has to say, hey, these are the filters and this is what we do. But someone also has to determine what the line in the sand is between something that's, you know, let's say indecent content and something that's maybe educational, but, you know, somebody might find it indecent, whereas this person doesn't. Who's managing that?
I think so. The bills vary from state to state. They're all kind of based on the same basic premise and basic language. But in Rhode Island, I believe in particular, it's the burden is on the device manufacturer. So if you get an iPhone, in theory, these filters come pre-installed by Apple or by, you know, Google or whatever, whoever makes your phone. And I think in theory, they would be regulated by the states. But like I said, it's just such an insurmountable task. I can't see any of these things passing. But it's just so fascinating that there is this such everlasting interest in trying to restrict the access, but they don't want to, say, fund a study or, you know, try and figure out what are the effects or figure out other ways to tell people about sexual activity. That's just never part of the equation. What they say that they're trying to do is stopping sex trafficking or trying to stop child pornography. Now it's trendy to say you want to stop revenge porn, but they don't ever talk about, you know, educating people on those issues. It's always just about, we're just going to divert funds away or something. Like there's never, and the reason I think they don't never include those kinds of solutions is because they don't involve sex workers. They don't involve industry stakeholders. They don't involve like actual adolescents in these conversations. So that's why I think a lot of the legislation ends up being so tone deaf.
Stoic Squirrel in our chat room says, I'd rather they try banning white supremacists first. It's a lot more damaging to society. They're a lot more damaging to society than porn. And you write that there's not any significant research out there that says pornography is damaging to children.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are like some preliminary studies that show that they inform how people think about sex. But I think that it would be great if you took some of these funds and instead of, you know, funneling them towards designing a content filter, if you funneled them towards, you know, figuring out some of that research. Like, I think there's so much you could learn from talking to kids about what they're experiencing and what they're learning. And I think that, you know, part of the sex education we should include part of, you know, sex education is just not about how to put a condom on a banana, but also, you know, what you might be seeing in porn is not necessarily real. I think we have to have those conversations with teens.
Absolutely. I'm also kind of thinking about the fact that right now, you know, more than a lot of times in recent internet history, you know, with the kind of the eradication of net neutrality rules, where we're at with all that changing, do you think laws like this have more, like it's easier to fathom these kind of laws in the current mentality that is this net neutrality ejection period that we're in right now?
I think because of some of the Supreme Court cases that came out in the 1990s, it's going to be really difficult to pass anything like this, even without net neutrality, because they're going to be deemed unconstitutional, unlike in the UK, which is already thinking about implementing some of similar regulations. Right. Because basically what it comes down to is that you're restricting adults' access to content that they have a First Amendment right to access, and you can't overburden their access to that. And that's kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that the internet has definitely become more vulnerable. And I think that, you know, states can do more to regulate this kind of content than they could have in the past.
You also write about MindGeek, and they're like the Amazon of porn now. Like they own Pornhub and they own YouPorn. They own everything. Like, and their argument was like putting a kind of technology, even though it's their technology, putting a technology in there might make parents think, well, then, you know, I don't have to do anything. I've got MindGeek is doing it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think MindGeek is such a fascinating company that a lot of people don't know about. Like, I think it kind of reminds me of how you don't know that certain magazines are owned by the same company. You know, like basically all of the major porn companies are owned by MindGeek, which is this Luxembourg-based company that's pretty mysterious and doesn't really talk much. I also think it's hilarious. They have horrible Glassdoor reviews. So apparently working at the giant porn company is really not that fun, which is really shocking. But yeah, that's kind of been the industry line for years, is that they don't want to take this responsibility because they think that it's a responsibility that belongs with parents. You know, parents should be deciding what their kids have access to, and what we should be investing in is building, you know, customer facing tools, not tools that are legally mandated, but, you know, tools that are easy to use for parents so that, you know, if you don't want your 7-year old to be able to access porn for the first time, that there is some sort of filter. But that's something that you decide with your kids, is not something that your state representative decides, is kind of their line of thinking.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. I mean, we always talk about, oh, this is so new, but it's the same argument about mm-hmm. sex education, right? Really. Like, yes, as a parent, I know it's my responsibility, but there has to be something else, because all parents aren't going to fulfill this responsibility. And what is that something else without, you know, I don't know. It's a tough one. But thank you so much for writing about this article. Really interesting, really enlightening. Louise Matsakis has written for Motherboard and Mashable, and she is now a staff writer at Wired. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Thank you.